forever. Dog.
Welcome to Public Intellectual. I'm your host, Jessa Crispin. As you well know by now, Public Intellectual is supported solely by its listeners. So if you would like to become a supporter, please go to patreon.com/publicintellectual. For a small donation a month, you can get access to a blog, bonus episodes, tote bags, the usual Patreon bribery. So please go to patreon.com/publicintellectual. In this era of Me Too and growing feminist awareness, it's important to rethink how these issues that are coming to the surface for the first time in a long time and being taken seriously need to be addressed. Issues like domestic violence, sexual harassment, and sexual assault. Lee Goodmark's book, Decriminalizing Domestic Violence, challenged assumptions that I had made over the years about the best way to not only prevent, but to intervene in domestic violence situations. She's also the author of A Troubled Marriage, Domestic Violence, and the Legal System, and she's a professor of law and director of the Gender Violence Clinic at the University of Maryland here in Baltimore. So we speak with Goodmark about her experience working with women in the legal system, the trendy domestic violence as entertainment, and how a system meant to protect women often puts them at greater risk. I wanted to start about talking about how handling domestic violence as a criminal problem has failed us. And so could you just go through some of the history that you cover in your book about how we got to the place that we are and your sort of counterintuitive idea that maybe the criminal justice system isn't the right place to be handling these cases at all?
If you go back to the 1960s, you will find in the police training manuals of the time instructions to police that say, if you go to a domestic call, don't arrest anyone, tell the guy, and it was always a guy then, and it was always a married couple then, to take a walk around the block until he cools down. And that was absolutely the way that those cases were handled at that time. Mm-hmm. And there were a series of things that happened that made people start to look differently at criminal legal system intervention in those cases. And it all kind of came to a head in 1984. Three things happened in 1984. One is the Attorney General's Task Force on Family Violence says domestic violence is a criminal problem. It needs a criminal solution. My fun footnote to that is Judge Jeannie Pirro, who's now all over Fox News, was one of the members of that task force. But it's the first time anyone in the federal government says this is a criminal problem. The second thing that happens is the Minneapolis domestic violence experiment, where for the first time there's social science research that says arrest may decrease recidivism in domestic violence cases. And the authors of the study at that time say, now this needs replication, don't rely on it. But people get very taken with the idea that arrest is going to be the thing that stops domestic violence. The third thing that happens is a lawsuit called Thurman versus City of Torrington, Connecticut. Tracy Thurman had been abused by her husband, Charles, throughout their marriage very seriously, culminating in her stabbing, which left her paralyzed partially while the police basically sat there and watched. And so that led to a multimillion dollar verdict in Tracy Thurman's favor. So jurisdictions all over the country were looking at law enforcement's failure to intervene, seeing that it was finally costing them money and saying, what do we do about it? And there was arrest as the answer to that problem. So that's when, before that time, there had been class action lawsuits that challenged police failure to intervene, prosecutors' failure to intervene. But it's really those three events, I argue, that around which the anti-violence movement coalesces and starts to push a very heavy criminalization agenda. That is then exacerbated in 1994 by the passage of VAWA, which is a criminal bill, right? It's in the Omnibus Crime Bill of 1994, the one where Biden famously says, you know, Democrats are putting hundreds of thousands of cops on the streets. And it's very much a crime bill. And what VAWA did, VAWA is a funding bill. People don't always understand that. But what VAWA does is give money. And what VAWA does primarily is give money to the criminal legal system. And so hundreds of millions of dollars then were being directed into courts and cops and prosecutors and other activities, so long as they supported courts and cops and prosecutors. VAWA creates partnerships or facilitates partnerships, I should say, between community-based organizations and law enforcement. But you only get those grants if you're helping law enforcement in some way. Mm-hmm. So at that time, VAWA, the first iteration of VAWA, says you don't get these grant funds unless you have a mandatory arrest law. Mandatory arrest is the idea that when police go to the scene of a domestic violence case and there are grounds to arrest, they must make an arrest. There is no discretion. There's no longer the ability to say, take a walk around the block. So not surprisingly, arrest rates start to go up and prosecution rates don't. And the anti-violence movement looks at prosecutors and says, what's the problem? And prosecutors say, the problem is that people don't want to testify in these cases, that women won't take these cases forward. And again, still talking largely about women at that time. Mm-hmm. And so the anti-violence movement and prosecutors come up with something called no-drop prosecution. And this is all oversimplified, but no-drop prosecution is the idea that prosecutors will take a case forward if they have the evidence to do so, whether the person who has been harmed wants to do that or not. Mm-hmm. And in some jurisdictions, that meant trying to kind of softly coerce the person into compliance. But in other jurisdictions, what that has meant is that people who have been harmed have been subpoenaed. And if they fail to comply with subpoenas to show up for court, they are arrested and sometimes they are held. And so the buildup of criminalization around domestic violence in the United States is really a movement made up of anti-violence advocates and conservative law and order people. And that's Democrats and Republicans, conservative law and order people, mm-hmm. Who are interested in beefing up the legal system's response to this problem. And my argument is that that hasn't worked. And the way that you get there is kind of two ways. One is to ask, you know, are the rates actually falling? So from 1994 to 2000, so 1994 passage of the Violence Against Women Act to the year 2000, rates of domestic violence fall significantly in the United States. So does the overall crime rate. And they fall exactly the same amount. From 2000 to 2010, while the Violence Against Women Act is still putting hundreds of millions of dollars into the criminal legal system, rates of domestic violence fall less than the drop in the overall crime rate. So even while we're pouring all this money into these systems, the rates aren't dropping the way that just natural attrition in the crime rate is happening. So I think that makes you ask, is criminalization working? Mm. The second way to look at it is, what do we mean by working, right? Do we mean recidivism? Do we mean happiness among those who've been harmed? Do we mean some feeling that justice has been achieved in some way? And that's all much more complicated to measure.
Yeah, it seems like so much of the story about domestic violence is now taken up with the criminal justice system. Typically what you hear in a lot of these conversations is that, well, if we just sort of double down on the criminal justice system, the problem is still that the criminal justice system doesn't take it seriously enough. So if we pour more resources into these projects, then we'll start to see results. And you see that both in sort of domestic violence and in, you know, cases of date rape and that sort of thing. But so how do we start to change the conversation away from handling this through the justice system?
So I think what's interesting about that doubling down is that you can't look at domestic violence in a vacuum. You've got to see it against the backdrop of mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. And that's partly what's changing the conversation. And I should say, you know, there were people in the anti-violence community, notably women of color, saying from the beginning, this is a bad idea. This will be bad for our communities. This is not going to work for us. We didn't listen. Mm-hmm. They were right. So looking now at, against the backdrop of mass incarceration, if we doubled down or really quadrupled or quintupled down on domestic violence, what that would mean is there are 900,000 approximately discrete acts of domestic violence each year. And in an era where we are concerned about mass incarceration, the number of folks incarcerated right now is about 2.2 million. So if we arrested, convicted, and incarcerated all of these people, we would increase mass incarceration by close to a third. It seems to me that that is unlikely and seriously unwise and also not cost effective in any kind of real way. The problem, I think, with the criminal legal response is that it looks at after the fact outcomes, but it doesn't look at causes. And it's only trying to deal with symptoms without dealing with causes. And if we started to look at symptoms and looked at the problem differently, then we might make a difference. So in the book, I argue that we need to look at economics, and we need to look at community accountability strategies, and we need to look at public health strategies. And all of these are designed to deal with some of the things that cause intimate partner violence, and to try to create strength within communities to address intimate partner violence before it gets to the point where somebody does need to be locked up. I'm not a prison abolitionist, I say yet. I'm much closer to one than I was when I started doing this work at 24. Yeah. I still think there may be some folks who need to not be among us for some period of time because they are such a danger to their partners and to other people. But the vast majority of this, I think, can be dealt with differently. And we're so afraid to try anything new that we're not taking those same resources, for example, and putting them into things like job creation. Mm-hmm. So in the economics section, one of the things I talk about is the fact that under and unemployed men are much more likely to commit intimate partner violence. So what that suggests to me is that maybe we should think about how we employ men, particularly in an era in which globalization and, you know, the death of factory work and kind of all the trends that are happening economically are making it so hard for people to keep living wage work. Mm-hmm. One of the things we need to be really thinking about is how do we do that? And there's a real resistance among some of the feminist anti-violence community, and I am part of the feminist anti-violence community too. Sure. But there's a resistance among some of the feminist community to put resources into men, right? I think that's unwise. If men are committing the vast majority of intimate partner violence, which they still are, then they are the problem. And we need to figure out how we solve that problem.
Mm-hmm. So what is it that women and men who are facing violence from their intimate partners, what do they say that they want when they come for help?
That's such a great question. And partly it's a great question because we can't really answer it yet. there's not terrific research, but some people want retribution, right? And for those people, the criminal legal system is a great place to be, right? That's what you get there. But most people don't. Most people want their relationships to be good, but nonviolent. They want their partners to be able to be with their partners without having to be afraid of their partners. They want some sense that they are heard. So in many studies, victims talk about voice and validation and vindication, right? Voice, I just want somebody to hear what I have to say about this. And validation, I want my community to say, we hear you. And vindication, I want my community to say, and what was done to you was wrong. So how do we fix it? And how do we help you fix it? And that's the movement around community accountability, around restorative justice, the idea that we've ceded the ability to address problems that involve violence to the state. And communities no longer are interested in trying to do that kind of intervention. Most folks don't go to law enforcement first. They don't go to courts and cops first. They go to family and friends first. They go to community-based resources first. So why aren't we resourcing them to be able to do this work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like when somebody talks about domestic violence, when the woman expresses a desire to stay within the relationship, then she's treated as being delusional or misguided. And so the idea is to sever the relationship for them. Like that's the best sort of thing. So it just seems like that part of the conversation doesn't help. The restorative justice idea, I've seen some videos of like rape cases, and it seems really powerful and also incredibly hard for the victim. So much more harder, I think, even than as much as people complain about the criminal justice system and what's that like for the rape victim, like to be there and to have to listen to and experience the resistance of the person who offended you or violated you. Seems much harder, but the payoff seems much bigger. But it does seem like such a fringe idea or activity. What's your experience with restorative justice?
It is still a pretty fringe activity, in part because of the real fear that the anti-violence community has about employing it. first, there's this idea that, you know, we fought to make domestic violence a public matter, to have the state become involved in dealing with domestic violence. If we use restorative justice, we're reprivatizing, and that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And so there isn't a tremendous amount of data to draw on. There's a lot of good anecdote. Anecdote is not data, but there's really interesting work that's been done in the United States in a couple of different pockets around restorative justice. And it's, you have to be really careful with it, right? It's not going to work for everybody. Mm-hmm. In my way of thinking about it, you don't do restorative justice, for example, unless the offender is willing to say, yes, I did this and I take responsibility for it, right? If that person's not going to take responsibility, you never put them in the same room. Mm-hmm. That's going to get rid of a substantial number of cases right there. But if we create a mindset that says, if you can accept responsibility for what you've done, then we can think about how to make this right without you having to go through this criminal legal system that has implications for your future employment, for your ability to vote, for your ability to get any kind of loans for your education, all of the collateral consequences that go with criminalization. If we can say to people, there are really good reasons to think about doing this, and then we do the work right so that we do serious prep work with both people who've done harm and people who've been harmed so that when they get in their room, there is no damage. Right? And we think about maybe we adapt the way that restorative justice is done in certain situations. People tend to conflate restorative practices and restorative ideology. The practices are pretty malleable. You can think a lot about how you want to do this kind of work using these same principles, right? Using the same questions of what was the harm, what was the impact of the harm, and what do we need to do to make it right? Mm-hmm. So I think that there's a real interest in exploring this among the anti-violence community now. There's money for the first time in the bill that's stalled right now, in the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization that's stalled right now. There's money to look at restorative programs for the first time. And I think that's a really positive development. Nobody who doesn't want to do it should ever do it. Mm. It should never be mandatory. It should never be, to my thinking, something that becomes an assembly line form of justice. It's got to be done right. That's why it will never be everything that we do in these cases, because it's too expensive and too time consuming. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to think about is, what is the entire menu of services and supports and programs that we need to help people address these issues without relying on the criminal legal system? And that's one piece of it, but it's not the only piece.
Obviously, part of the problem of using the criminal justice system is that the prison industrial complex is not interested in rehabilitation, right? It's not interested in counseling. It's not interested in trying to keep anybody from reoffending. It's just punishment. And so it doesn't feel like in our culture we understand what rehabilitation of this type of violence even looks like. Do you know what it looks like? Can you tell us?
So unfortunately, the research on offender intervention as it's currently practiced is not all that promising. And that's depressing and problematic, right? For somebody who wants us to get away from the criminal legal system. Mm. I think part of the reason for that is that we've assumed that we know why people use violence, but we haven't really studied it. And what I mean by that is, if you talk to most people in the anti-violence community about domestic violence, they will tell you it's about power and control. Mm-hmm. And while power and control may be the outcomes, I'm not sure they're the motivators. And until we understand what motivates people to use violence, I don't think we can do really effective intervention. If you look, for example, at the data on trauma, and on adverse childhood experiences, what you see is that somebody who's had more adverse childhood experiences is much more likely to be abusive. And maybe that's about asserting control over an out-of-control life in some way, but I'm not sure that's about asserting control over a partner in the same way that we think about it now. Mm. So how do we intervene around that kind of trauma, right? The anti-violence movement generally has been unwilling to look at the trauma of perpetrators because it feels like an excuse. But it's not an excuse, it's an explanation. And until we can hold those two ideas in our hands at the same time, the idea that someone could have experienced trauma and the idea that they are then using harm, they're harming others, until we can look at both of those things at the same time, we're not going to have good interventions. There's a program that's through the VA called the Strength at Home Men's Program that looks at veterans who've experienced PTSD who are then abusive in their relationships. Mm-hmm. That's doing an amazing job of kind of looking at, this is the PTSD that you suffered may be motivating some of this behavior, and that doesn't make it okay. Mm-hmm. So let's acknowledge the trauma you've experienced, and then let's figure out what we do about it.
Mm-hmm. So if we're dealing with both sort of intervention and rehabilitation and prevention as well, it seems like intervening with childhood trauma, childhood sexual abuse and physical abuse for young boys is just as important as, I do think that so much of the focus in the last 20, 30 years because of feminism has been on the abuse of young girls and being silent, except for within the sort of, church scandals. There hasn't been a cultural conversation about the abuse that boys experience.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And again, until we address trauma among men, both childhood trauma and adult trauma among men, we're not going to make a dent in this problem. The irony for me of the criminal legal system is that we take people who use violence and we put them into prisons where they are witnesses to or experience violence. Mm-hmm. And then we send them back out into communities without having done anything to alleviate that trauma. We've re-traumatized them. They take that back into their relationships and their relationships are more violent. And why anybody is surprised by this, I don't understand.
I watch a lot of trashy television, including a lot of domestic violence television. And we've had a lot of it lately. And I was obsessed with the Dirty John podcast. And also I watched Big Little Lies, even though I knew as I was watching it that I should not be watching this and I should just do something more redeemable with my time. But it does seem like now, I don't know if it has an effect on the way that we think about domestic violence, but to have these very successful TV shows that portray domestic violence in a kill or be killed way of the abusive man as the monster who can never be reasoned with or talked to, it doesn't seem like that has a good effect on the conversation.
I don't think it does. I think it really skews our understanding in so many different ways. And I watched Big Little Lies too. There probably were much better ways for me to be spending my time. And it made me crazy. And it made me crazy because, Nicole Kidman is not your typical person who's right. experienced intimate partner violence. Yeah. And the character that she plays has resources. Since the beginning of the anti-violence movement, there's been this real push to say, domestic violence affects all of us and it could be you and it could happen to anyone, right? Mm-hmm. Without acknowledging that while that's true, it disproportionately affects people of color. It disproportionately affects low-income people. It changes in really significant ways your ability to respond to violence. Intersectionality is so key to this analysis. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's oversaid, but it really, intersectional analysis of intimate partner violence is absolutely essential. Yeah. So you get a rich white woman who's got friends and resources and then rents herself that cute little apartment at the end.
Yeah.
And it just kind of made me furious where I was like, that wonderful. Like, that's great if you're Nicole Kidman and you've got the resources to get a little apartment for you and your boys. But most of my clients, and I still represent clients in court and I've done it for almost 25 years now. Most of my clients don't have the ability to pay their rent, mm-hmm. right? On their horrible little apartments, let alone to get a second house in Malibu.
Right.
And so what people understand about the violence is skewed by this rich white woman's experience, mm-hmm. right? And then the Alexander Skarsgård character, who is absolutely unredeemable, who, there is nothing about him to like.
And yet super, super sexy.
And yet super hot, right? And so you're left with that kind of ambivalent and dirty feeling yourself where you're, weighing those two things. Is supposed to say to you, well, that's why she stays with him. Well, mm-hmm. maybe, but, and one of the things we don't talk about in the movement at all is love. Mm-hmm. People love their partners. There's a reason that people are with their partners, and it's pretty rare for someone to be abusive on day one. So by the time that someone is abusive, you have built up this reservoir of love and trust and expectation and dependency in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. That it's really hard to turn your back on. It's such a caricature of domestic violence. And I didn't watch the Dirty John show. Mm-hmm. I thought the articles did a decent job of showing how entrapped she got. But again, it's just a very different kind of cultural setting mm-hmm. from where a lot of the violence that I deal with takes place that really constrains people's options in ways that are very, very different than what you saw.
Yeah. I mean, it's Wealth in the Dirty John series as well, which is she can just afford to hire movers at a moment's right. notice, and be moved out and have a place rented that whole night. And the thing that bothered me about Big Little Lies is she did have the ability to leave. She did have the resources, and then they killed him anyway. Like through this idea that if a man hits a woman, that he is a monster right. and like no longer human. And that
binary is bad for women too. And we have, we've largely been talking about cis hetero relationships, right? And this is all much more complicated than that. But that binary really plays out in ways that are problematic for women, because if men are demons, then women have to be angels. And very few women are angels. And women fight back. When they do so, they lose all credibility in terms of the stories that they're able to tell to get protection from community resources, courts, and others. Mm-hmm. If they are not absolutely blameless, then they are not victims. And that really problematic conceptions of victimhood there.
Yeah. The only movie that I saw that has a sort of realistic to the point where I, had to go cry in the bathroom for a little bit after was I, Tonya, where she was obviously not as violent, but she was violent as well and feeding into it. And that dynamic, how it just became so entangled. And it was really the only realistic depiction of domestic violence I've ever seen in entertainment.
What I thought was interesting about I, Tonya, was that it plays with this idea, right? That you can use violence, but not be an abuser, mm-hmm. right? When Tonya is using violence, she is fighting back. She's trying to avert worse violence against herself. She's trying to stand up for herself. We talk about domestic violence as though one slap means that you've committed domestic violence. And it's much more nuanced than that. And so in the field, when people talk about it, we talk about coercive control. We talk about the ways in which physical violence is just one of kind of a suite of behaviors that allow you to exert control over another person. Again, whether that's the intent or not, that somehow limits their liberty. When Tonya hits Jeff, she's not going to limit his liberty in any way. And she's probably going to get hurt worse for it. And that is a realistic depiction mm-hmm. of what it looks like when women use violence.
Yeah. So I'm always a little bit skeptical when somebody talks about community response to domestic violence, because I come from a very small town. And we pride ourselves on our sense of community. And yet domestic violence was rampant. So I liked about your book, one of the things I liked about your book was talking about how to build awareness within communities and not just assume that everybody, if there is a sort of, tight community, the people are looking out for each other, because these tight communities often have very patriarchal notions. So can you talk a little bit about that, about what it takes to kind of break that awareness in?
Yeah, absolutely. Communities foster violence, right? So the idea that all of a sudden a community is going to say, yes, let us support you and do all these things that we failed to do forever and ever is really naive. But there's really interesting work going on to build capacity within communities. And it requires a couple of things. One, it's an understanding of what violence is. A lot of communities have never taken the time to kind of stop and observe and say, what are the ideals that we have here? What makes them right or wrong? And those, again, problematic binaries. But what makes them problematic for some folks? What makes them foster violence in ways that are problematic? And there's really interesting work that goes on in cultural communities around pulling out, what are the core beliefs of this community and how do they square with the violence that's happening? And how do we use those core beliefs to challenge other things that are happening? And that happens in ethnic communities and cultural communities and religious communities. And what that does is then it gives people the opportunity to turn to those communities for assistance. And the other piece, another kind of piece of restorative justice is the idea that it creates learning among communities. That when you turn to community and say, how are you going to help keep this person safe? How are you going to hold this person accountable? People have to look inside themselves to say, what are the things that I'm doing that perpetuate this kind of violence and how do I stop them? So this assumption, right, that we have nonviolent communities, of course, we don't have nonviolent communities. If we did, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Mm-hmm. But there is work that can be done that names problems, that brings them to light, that helps people see how their behavior is fostering an environment where that violence can continue to grow, without shaming people, without suggesting that they have failed in some way, showing them that there is a way that they can become involved that's productive and useful and supportive. And I think that that's part of what we need to be thinking about. And organizations like Creative Interventions in the Bay Area have been doing that work for years, where they've created this amazing 600-page toolkit for communities that says kind of, if you want to help deal with violence in your community, here's how you do it. So there's great work going on in communities to try to make that happen. There's great work right here in Baltimore that a group called Gather Together is doing to try to make that happen.
So much of this has to do with money and the limited resources outside of the criminal justice system for women who are experiencing violence or men who are experiencing violence. If VAWA is primarily a funding bill, how in your dream would that money be better allocated? Like, how could that be made more useful without necessarily like increasing the amount of money that we have?
We have been paying hundreds of millions of dollars into the criminal legal system for the last 40 years. You would think that folks had got the training that they needed, that policies have been developed and cultures had been created in those environments. And it hasn't done us that much good. So I am good with taking that money and putting it elsewhere. And the big places I would put it are into economic assistance for people who've been abused, right? Put real economic power into women's hands, not just you can get this shelter assistance because people don't like shelter. Nobody wants to go into shelter, but give people really concrete money in their hands so that they have the ability to do what they need to do. Put economic resources into men's job creation. Look at what the impact of that is, right? There, in the last years of the Obama White House, the Council of Economic Advisors did a study that showed if you raise the minimum wage to $13 an hour, you would decrease crime significantly, right? And it's not hard, right? That's not hard. You could do that. Take that money, do that. Take that money, put it into public health prevention. Put it into intervening with parenting supports for people who are having issues, who are struggling, right? Before they are abusive or neglectful of their children, which is going to lead down the road to some of these problems. Put it into interventions in middle schools where we're helping kids see this is unhealthy relationship behavior. What do I do about it before they're in really adult type relationships? Put it into looking at guns, right? And doing that research that we've not been allowed to do for years and years and years, because there's a ton of research out there that tells you if we could get guns out of the community, we would decrease domestic violence homicide by a significant amount. Mm-hmm. Those are the places where I'd like to see that money go, into community, into prevention, and into economic assistance for both men and women and all folks who may be committing or having violence committed against them.
Yeah. It does seem like there is throughout the domestic violence conversation, a unwillingness to trust women who have found themselves in this situation. So the sort of immediate thought of putting money in the hands of these women is like, well, what are they going to do with it? Right. When talking about wanting to stay in the relationship, it's like, well, you must be sort of zombied out or whatever, or under his spell. So how do we sort of, I don't think Big Little Lies is the way to go with this particular thing and just assume all of them are Nicole Kidman, but how do we start to trust that women who found themselves in these situations are not deluded or silly or whatever it is.
Isn't it part of our bigger problem that we don't trust women with anything?
Yeah.
I mean, trust women, period, would be the answer to that question. But I do think for those folks who need an empirical basis, there is great scholarship out there that suggests that in some settings, putting resources into women's hands decreases violence. Mm-hmm. So looking at the micro-lending literature, for example, and it's controversial, right? Mm-hmm. There's definitely conflicts among the literature, but there is an empirical basis for giving people that kind of power. And then thinking about what kind of state is it that we want to have, right? Because it's part of looking at anti-violence efforts in a silo is a mistake. We've done that. And what that's meant is that we haven't looked at it in the context of anti-racist work. We haven't looked at it in the context of anti-poverty work. We haven't looked at it in this bigger social context where it really needs to be embedded, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we were theorizing, what a vision of a helping state would be, one that I wouldn't be afraid to send my clients into, or myself for that matter.
Sure.
Because I wouldn't call the police, I don't think, any more than any of my clients likes to call the police. What would that look like for us? And a big core part of that would have to be you trust women. You trust that people know what's good for them. The big disservice the anti-violence movement has done to women is to say, you can't make decisions for yourself. You're so coercively controlled mm-hmm. that you've lost the ability to make decisions for yourself. And I've represented probably 1,000 clients at this point, and many of them were controlled by their partners, but they could still make decisions, right? In casting women in this victimization narrative that says they are so coerced that they can't possibly make decisions for themselves, and therefore, for example, we should choose to prosecute whether they want to or yeah. not, we've deprived these same women of choice in lots of other parts of their lives. And it's made it very easy for people to kind of take that, well, we can't possibly trust them kind of attitude. I trust my clients. I trust the women that I've dealt with. I think they know what's best for them. And I think that's what the literature shows as well.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.